Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, which goes out every Friday afternoon at 2pm on BCFM. This week, victims of miscarriages of justice are growing, in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. Well, there's also the Conservative Lib Dem coalition's withdrawal of legal aid too. But fear not, to the rescue comes Victims Unite Red website and contributors Sabine McNeil and Maurice Kirk. More too in our weekly series with Peruvian-born US filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall back in 1994. Yes, we're back in 2013 for the new year. And we have the weekly What Song Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. And the number is 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. After some music now, we will have a chat about Victims Unite after John Martin.
May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never make your bed out in the cold. Just like a written song, brother of mine, behind my back, and I know that there's those that do. Oh, please, won't you be reading mine? Love is a lesson to learn in our time. Oh, please, won't you be reading mine for me? May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never to me, you know that I love you true. You hold no blade to stab me in the back, and I know that some do.
John Martin there with May You Never. And I'm joined on the line, I hope, by Sabine McNeil from Victims Unite. Hi, Sabine. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Hello. Right. Would you like to just refresh our memories on your website, Victims Unite? Why was it created in the first place?
Well, I needed to group cases to change the law, according to Lord Sudley, with whom I had started the Forum for Stable Currencies at the House of Lords. And to group cases meant we had to gather descriptions of people's cases. People who have been made fraudulently bankrupt used to come to meetings of the Forum for Stable Currencies that are organized, thanks to Lord Sudley, at the House of Lords. But I always felt too helpless and powerless until the web came along and WordPress and blogging. And I began to put cases together. Actually, the first site was still on the enforcement of Bank of England Act 1694. In other words, very much referring to the whole issue of the creation of money. Until then, I felt, well, it needs a site on its own. And that's what I launched in August 2010.
Can you tell us about some of those cases of people being made fraudulently bankrupt? Obviously, you know, if someone has worked very hard to save money and build up a business of one sort or another, it's really rather frustrating to have fraud committed against you and then lose everything.
Well, it's not frustrating that fraud is committed against you. What is much more frustrating is that the fraud isn't investigated, that in the process of you trying to defend your rights, you find out that lawyers don't act professionally, insolvency practitioners don't act professionally, police doesn't act professionally. So you just find that there is nobody who operates in your interest at all. And what is worse is that at the end, you may end up becoming a vexatious litigant or even sectioned or even criminalized. It is just absolutely horrendous what I've seen.
Is this just really pot luck with maybe getting a bad lawyer?
No. I had just had the privilege of speaking to a person who has been teaching law between China and Peru for 44 years. And who had to act as Mackenzie Friend for his son, and he didn't even know the term until he was delighted to find my other website, which is about the Association of Mackenzie Friends, because that's what then happened, that victims, because they have had to fight for and fend for themselves, because lawyers didn't help them, and I can assure you it's not a matter of potluck. This professor or former professor has just confirmed exactly the same. He didn't know and didn't expect that it took for that profession to behave as unprofessionally. And in the same way, that's what victims have discovered. So they end up becoming what they call litigants in person. And they help each other. And in that fashion, one becomes a Mackenzie Friend. As a lay legal advisor, as you know, in French you would say par la force des choses, you just are being forced into that situation. You can't go on and just getting ripped off or being badly advised.
Well, surely there are some good lawyers out there. You seem to be painting a bit of a one-sided picture of all these lawyers who are somehow, for whatever reason, you know, not helping the victims.
Well, of course, I don't have a reason to kind of make polls amongst lawyers, but why is there a site called Solicitors from Hell? I mean, it wouldn't be necessary for such a site to go up if people hadn't had the experience, and I did not produce that site.
No, okay. Tell us about this Forum for Stable Currencies. What was that about? Because I think you can see on one side people thinking, well, this is interesting that you're trying to defend people who've been made bankrupt fraudulently. But what's that got to do with having a stable currency?
Well, the whole issue of the supposed complexity of the money system is just not understood. And if more people understood it, and if people didn't listen to economics but just understood what money is and who has the privilege of creating money, there wouldn't be as many victims of when matters where money is involved. That's sort of ultimately my thinking, that a dishonest money system is the cause of white-collar criminals committing white-collar crimes, and so we end up having victims. And mainly, I, from my attempt to influence and lobby Parliament via the Treasury Select Committee, which I had been advised by a human rights lawyer, not getting anywhere with the Forum for Stable Currencies, with the contributions to select committees, I then decided, okay, I better just leave those websites, at least they are there for the record, so to speak, and concentrate on the effects of such a system on the victims.
Okay.
At long last, because there were websites, because there were blogs, I felt I could do something for them, because I realized they couldn't even write their own summaries. They are so involved and so traumatized and victimized, they don't have the distance to describe their case in an, if you like, a journalistic matter. I try to put the two together as and when I can.
Okay, well, I mean, you're saying, and I think many people, probably 99.9% of people listening would agree with you, that the money system isn't working. But what, in a nutshell, what's wrong with it, and how, in your experience, are there any easy, reasonably quick fixes to it?
Well, the quick fixes depend on the position you're in. I mean, you know, the governor of the Bank of England can do the quickest, biggest fix. But I've now just discovered cute, new, young entrepreneurs who set up Bank to the Future as a way. The guy says on his video, and I met him last night personally, we are running a bank in the way that people think banks are run. So a banker can make a difference. A central banker can make the biggest difference. And otherwise, of course, the chancellor could make a huge difference. But the difference depends on the context, if you like.
Yeah, so, I mean, put yourself in the chancellor's shoes, if you can, for a minute, Sabine. And also, you know, maybe with another foot in the shoe of the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, or this new Mark Carney guy who's coming along. You know, what should they be doing? What action should they be taking to fix it?
Well, the chancellor, assuming that he wants to kind of stand up to the Bank of England rather than kowtow, he should follow our submission that we put together at the time of the Stern Review, where Sir Nicholas Stern made an inquiry about climate change. So we put it there for, we made our proposal green credit for green purposes, i.e., the government should create interest-free money, which it does by printing notes and minting coins. And banks should stop creating credit and from thin air. And since central banks, therefore, should discourage or disallow banks from creating money from thin air, and certainly not do it themselves and call it quantitative easing.
Well, what's wrong? Because, I mean, that's what I was about to ask you. I was going to say, well, Mervyn King has been doing billions and billions, tens of billions of quantitative easing. Isn't that what you're asking for?
Absolutely not, because the government creates cash interest-free, and he and the whole of the city create credit at interest. It doesn't cost them anything, not even the cost to mint a coin or to print a note. And on top of it, they charge interest. And on top of it, they dare to lend it to governments of all people. And then you end up with as high an amount of interest payments in the governmental budget as the military budget every year. And it's called public spending, PSBR, public spending borrowing requirement. There's no borrowing requirement at all. The Chancellor should just print his own money.
Do you think George Osborne is up to the job then? Because, I mean, he's surely, I mean, if he can just do this and sort out the financial crisis at the click of a finger, you would have thought he would do it. I mean, I know that the new Archbishop of Canterbury is apparently got more qualifications now in economics than the Chancellor or the Prime Minister.
The London School of Economics does not teach what money is. They were created to camouflage what bankers are doing. Vincent Cable, who was told me at, when I first met him, maybe he should learn what money is. The daughter of Alan Brown, who published The Web of Debt, was told she can't write her PhD about it because that's not capitalism. The difference between credit money and cash is that cash is interest-free and credit is inherently sold for at interest, and nobody creates the interest, and that's what's behind the inflation of the money supply.
So if nothing's done, I mean, if we carry on doing the same as we have done for the last 2 or 3 years since the Condem government, the coalition, took over here in Britain, I mean, where do you see this leading, Sabine?
The complete control of any currency through banks and completely unaccountable banks, completely unaccountable central banks, and governments which are totally in the pockets of the banks as well.
Because, I mean, it's seen to be a good thing that for the governor of the the Bank of England to be independent. Are you saying that he should be actually more part of the elected government or the Treasury rather than an independent banker? Because obviously that independence really means that he's a friend of the private banking system rather than a kind of public advocate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is, I mean, come on, George Osborne is part of the Rothschild Empire. And and central bankers are sort of kowtow to the central bank of central banks in Basel, and the whole money empire, the financial economy, is under the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and they all rely on creating on the privilege or the monopoly of being able to create credit. When all governments could create and print their own money, and then they just bring up this myth of inflation in the 20s in Germany. That was exactly when the London School of Economics was formed.
So you're actually German yourself. Can you give us a bit of an insight into what really happened, and why is it that they use that myth, as you put it?
Because it suits the bankers. It suits the bankers to, if you like, blame governments for printing money, but when they do it, then it's okay. But when bankers, when governments do it, it's not okay, according to them. And because they are always have the deeper pockets, they can always influence the media, and you know, play the tune that the pipers are going to perform.
Yeah, the other thing I know from history is that the American president, Abraham Lincoln, he printed government money back in the American Civil War and used it to fight the American Civil War and win and abolish slavery in the United States.
Absolutely. The greenback is the model. That's exactly it.
Now, back to what we started, which was the Victims Unite website. And one of the latest posts you've got on there is the Royal Commission into Child Abuse, when online petitioning becomes a threat of imprisonment. Now, that sounds a little bit scary. Are you implying there that people who are actually setting up online petitions are being threatened?
Well, this is what happened to poor old Michael Moran, and he asked me to publicize more and more, and I haven't gotten round to it yet, but I followed it up, and it boils down to an injunction that is 20 years old, because he has a list of pedophiles, and he threatened on and off to publish it, and that injunction, an injunction is also called a gagging order, which threatens with kind of if you break it, you are put into prison. I've got three of those because I published information about children who were snatched, and so I had to take posts down, and if I wanted to avoid imprisonment, and because I know people who have been imprisoned, one has to respect that.
But, I mean, surely the only reason you can take something down or should take something down is when you haven't actually got your facts straight, Sabine.
Well, this is a kind of naive thinking by now. I mean, I find it very funny to listen to myself because I used to be sort of in the same way naive, but by now I've become so disillusioned and so cynical, we just have to assume that what matters is the agenda of the criminals, and the criminals are just there to kind of make sure that whatever they want is what's going to happen. And an amazing example is a reference to a film called Unlawful Killing. I am fighting that my way, and I met somebody on the web in Australia whose website was taken down altogether. He only mentioned the film. He didn't even link to it, apparently.
This is the film which is really filmed by, financed by Mohammed Al-Fayed, filmed
exactly.
by Keith Allen and Victor Lewis Smith.
Yeah.
An hour, I think it's an hour and a half long, all about the inquest
yeah.
into the death of Princess Diana back in the 1990s.
Yeah. I saw it online, and I got this note. It wasn't yet a gagging order or injunction order, but they claim it was infringing copyright. I mean, no logic. Honestly, Tony, there is no logic behind any of the legal... It's just threat and speaking legalese. And
well, yes, but hang on, Sabine. I mean, you know, someone who owns the copyright in that film doesn't really want to have you distributing it around the internet.
I'm not distributing it. I linked to a site which didn't say whether it was or wasn't copyrighted at all. And that site doesn't exist anymore, and there is no official internet site. And therefore, I tried to find out from the owners, especially from the people who call themselves Web Sheriff, who asked WordPress to send me a note. If you produce the film, it's in your interest that it becomes known, isn't it? I haven't found it. I haven't gotten a proper answer. And fortunately, WordPress have not taken it down. HostGator took the site of this Australian guy down.
Yes, as far as I know, it's actually not in any way legally dodgy, whether that's a civil or criminal offence, to actually link to any site on the entire internet. It's only actually providing the content, which is illegal. Anyway, look, we're also joined by Morris Kirk, who contributes to your website from time to time. Morris, can you just give us an update on your legal situation? Because you've been in the courts in Cardiff, haven't you? And maybe, you know, I think you've probably got some stuff coming up soon as well. So maybe
yeah.
we better not talk about that. But any news to report?
Well, I'm lucky to get here tonight. I went to the Cardiff Crown Court today to follow up the right to listen to or get a copy of the CDs of the evidence in a previous trial, which is now before the criminal courts in London on appeal. I actually called the police to attend because, as we touched on last time, Tony, there is a difference. The River Severn divides quite different set of rules in our law courts.
But it's, the jurisdiction is for England and Wales, so surely it should be the same.
Yes, well, at Crown Court Bristol, is Crown Court anywhere. The rules and regulations in Bristol Crown Court should be identical to those in Cardiff, but oh no, 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 no. The head of the administration of the HM Court Service of the Courts of Wales have written to me saying I'm not allowed to enter any of the court buildings. So that means I can't even get papers over the public counter. And tonight was a classic example of where they refused to let me listen to the tapes. Now, I have listened to the tapes in England in my youth when I used to live in Taunton. And the court allowed me to. But, oh no, not in Wales.
Warren, I actually don't think it is the distinction between Wales and England anymore. I think I've become more cynical and disillusioned than you by now. The person I spoke to today was having the same kind of problem in Preston. And I asked him, since he called me from Aberystwyth, I asked him specifically also whether he thinks it's worse in Wales than in England. But we've discovered that there are seven so-called delivery directors that who determine basically what policy is all over UK and Wales. Now, they will be more or less in harmony with each other. And I think it's what is much more significant is that what happened in your youth is not happening what's now, because the whole trend is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Where the Australian book title is right, our corrupt legal system, where everybody is a victim except rich criminals.
So, Sabine, I remember meeting you for the first time at Dinar Airport. You were curious about me, and you came and stayed with me in Brittany for a few days. And in those days, you believed that if a judge said something, it was correct. And if a clerk of the court wrote something, it was correct. And I directed you in the direction of fact. And you have reminded me that, in fact, the standards in the last 20 years, fortunately, I'm fairly old, and I have got vast experience because I've been a litigant. I have been a witness. I've been in the civil courts, the crown courts, the prisons, the police stations. And I have a wide experience, but you are quite right. The standards in our courts, especially the family courts, which you and I have witnessed with a certain case in London, are appalling now, quite appalling. And of course, it's a money-grabbing business now. Money has completely dominated our judicial system. It is it is a way to print money, and there is no way of taxing the bills that the lawyers claim on the taxpayer. No one investigates. No one will release to you what a court case really cost the taxpayer.
Sabine, before we go, could you just tell us about an event which is sort of associated with your Victims Unite website? And that is this thing that's coming up next week at the House of Commons, which begins, anyway, Mind the Gap. What is it called and what's it all about?
Well, as the, if you like, the victims who turned into Starfighters and Mackenzie Friends actually got together as an association of Mackenzie Friends, and we identified seven deadly syndromes and seven media cover-ups. So we thought we'll present those under the label of Mind the Gaps between online and mainstream media and government and public, because it seems that what happens online is everybody knows, whereas in the mainstream media, everybody is fooled. So there is one guy called John Ward who publishes The Slog, who has had over 3 million visitors, in, whereas Victims Unite has only had 180,000 so far. And he tackles also paedophilia as well as the money problems, and he has basically called for action by saying that it's the blogosphere's destiny to be in opposition of cover-ups, and in a way that's our only hope. But John Hemming MP and also Mitchell MP helped us launch the Association of Mackenzie Friends last year, and Austin Mitchell has been the chairman of the Forum for Stable Currencies ever since we started. So we have these patrons, and they sponsor the two meetings where John Ward will be, and Vicky Hake is a high-profile victim of child snatching, and was also imprisoned fraudulently. And Belinda McKenzie, the co-founder of the Association of Mackenzie Friends and who is the spokesperson for the Holy Grail campaign. So child snatching is one of the seven deadly syndromes. And secret societies is another one. The illegality of usury and wars is another one. So we will obviously focus on different aspects, and not everybody can cope with all seven, but that's at least we know from our experiences that and how the media are completely complicit. I've seen that with victim stories and certainly family court stories. I've seen how the mainstream media completely turned round the conviction of Vicky Hakes. I had to close the website because of the negative comments I got based on the media coverage, which was false, because I just know it. I've seen all of the documents, and it is just so horrendous that for me it's a very, very difficult acrobatic act in a way to compensate injustice with publicity. But there was a famous person who said that where there is no publicity, there can't be justice, and I feel compelled to expose on the as a blogger what I feel is deeply unjust.
Okay, Sabine, thanks very much, and we'll have a report from you on that over the next couple of weeks. I hope to speak to you again soon.
With pleasure.
Thank you very much. And before we finish on the Victims Unite, I think what we'll do is also have a chat with Maurice. Remind us, Maurice, you know, you were originally, one of the reasons you came into this whole business was partly your role as the flying vet. I mean, you're basically a person who doesn't suffer fools gladly and certainly is not going to be the victim of an injustice without a bit of a fight. Remind us of your flying past a little, because I know you know, you're one of these people, I think, have you broken the record for engine failures? Because you've you seem to have been in like quite a lot of dicey situations up in the air.
Yes, well, I've had 14 donkey stops. Donkey stops meaning engine failures. I mean, everyone's got a big story, but the one that comes to mind, of course, was over the mountains near Kanazawa in Japan. I was flying this wartime Piper Cub around the world, and I'd managed to get to the top of Japan, and I was waiting for a strong wind to get me to Alaska. And technically, I had to fly 1,400 miles, which meant an awful lot of fuel, and the actual capacity of my cabin couldn't carry enough cans unless I had a 30-knot wind. Well, I waited for 3 weeks and eventually realised I wasn't going to make it. So I had to return. So I went towards Hiroshima, which I've always had a personal interest in, and I felt I had a duty to go and visit Hiroshima. And I was on the mountains just before there, Kanazawa, and the engine stopped. And I was quite low. And the glide path of the aeroplane with no engine is, it's downward. There's no question of getting lift as a glider. And I was on the way down. Now, fortunately, the slope of the mountain was the same as my glide slope. And my wheels were 20 feet, 30 feet above the forest. And I could smell the pine needles and everything. Well, the smell was unbelievable. And of course, it was silent. And absolutely silent, apart from the wind rushing here and there. Frantically trying to find somewhere to land. And I came out in sort of haze. I had a 10-knot, 15-knot headwind, well, about 12 mile an hour to 50 miles an hour headwind. And I saw the river in Kanazawa, big city. And I thought, right, I'll land in the city, in the river, can't help hurt anybody. And just as I was lining up, I saw a playing field. So I turned left into wind, which is the safest way to land because you land slower. And just as I was down to about 500 feet, I suddenly realised it was full of kids. And I could see that because I was shouting and the wind was into me, they weren't going to hear me shouting. I've had happen this on golf course before now, and I just shout, four. But I knew that the Japanese wouldn't hear me. So I saw a building site, building a dual carriageway. So I quickly turned right at very low level. I was now at 400 feet, so I used 100 feet to turn 90 degrees. So I now had the wind behind me, which meant I was going very fast, whether I liked it or not. And I suddenly, to my horror, realised there was a great web of wires and cables and telephone and electric wires across this road, and concrete machines and so on. And I realised that I had to find a hole in the cobweb of wires. And I could just see it. I could just see it. And I could see a line where I could live. And I had to put the aeroplane vertical to the ground when I was at 100 feet and get down through the hole in the wiring and then pull out just without hitting the ground. And with that impetus up to again 20 feet over the concrete blocks and a concrete lorry, making this dual carriageway. And I was going to get there. I could see it. I was going to make it. And I was just between a lorry and a lamppost. And I could see, I had 75 yards of runway to land on. I'd live. I knew I would live. And it was uphill. And a little old lady came out of her house. And I instinctively moved 2 metres, that's 6 feet. And I hit the lorry. 3 feet of my wing hit the lorry. And I did a pirouette all the way down the middle of the road, straight into another lorry, petrol tank straight through onto my belly, soaked in fuel, jumped out, ran like the proverbial, and 20 yards, I hit the ground and did serious damage to myself. I was tied to the aeroplane, wasn't I? I had the dinghy tied to my ankle so that if I ditched in the sea, I wouldn't lose my dinghy. And I was taken to hospital for the damage of me hitting the ground, not hitting the runway. And I then faced over 20 hours of Japanese interrogation, which I found fascinating. But that's another story.
Well, I mean, certainly equips you well for dealing with the courts, doesn't it? Surviving these kind of exploits, Maurice.
Yes, yes, it's a mere bagatelle, it's courts.
Thanks very much for joining us. And we're going to have a little bit of music, and then we're going to be talking with Jason Yannakopoulos this week about a new book that he's got anyway. I don't know if you got this for Christmas, did you, Jason?
It's not actually new, it's recently last five, but it's Disability and Social Policy in Britain since 1750 by Anne Bourzet.
Okay, first some more music though from John Martin. John Martin, Don't Want to Know. And I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello there, Tony.
Did you have a good Christmas, good New Year?
I had an interesting Christmas. I definitely had an interesting New Year, yes.
Yes, good. Okay, sounds to me like you had a few drunken spats and things like that. But anyway, let's talk about this this book you've brought in, Disability and Social Policy in Britain since 1750. What have you been learning there?
Well, it goes through the whole history of not only... it doesn't just cover the policies that affect disabled people over time, but it's also... sort of almost like pointed out its successes and failures. In fact, on the inside it says it's a history of exclusion, so it deals a lot in the exclusion of disabled people, and it's actually it's got three parts. It's actually really interesting because it talks a lot about it's got a whole chapter dedicated to the workhouse and mental hospitals. And
okay, well, just give us an idea. I mean, because the workhouse now is something you might see on an Ordnance Survey map as some kind of archaeological relic. What was the workhouse and what was the whole system there?
The whole system of the workhouse is that, you know, if there are any, how do I put it, maybe they would call it undesirables, I don't know, you know, people who weren't sure well-off working chap, they got sent to the workhouse to work for, well, nothing, really.
This is basically the forerunner to the doll, isn't it? I mean, funnily enough, the word doll, do you know where that comes from?
No, I've not.
Right, well, it's actually a medieval word, which comes from the old open field system. The dole was removed from the Encyclopaedia Britannica in around about 1650s and 1700s, so you won't find it in there anymore. But if you get, if you've got a copy of the Encyclopaedia Britannica from 1600 or earlier, which not a lot of people have got, you'll find in there that it's the dole is a part or portion, most commonly of a meadow, where several persons have shares. So when we talk about people being on the dole, actually in medieval times, if people were destitute, had no form of income and no kind of work, and they were sort of seen as superfluous to society, what they do is they always make sure that there was a little bit of land that they could use. So, you know, to be productive, in other words, to put a sheep on if they had a sheep, or to start growing food, that there was always an area in every village which was set apart for people who were destitute to either live on and or to grow food on. So there's that's where the dole comes from originally, a very, very ancient word and quite a wonderful word, I think. And it's not to do with just doling out, when they talk about rich people kind of giving something of their massive wealth to a few paupers. You know, that's actually not where the word comes from at all. So the workhouse, though, getting back to your book, wasn't it originally a place where people who were destitute and had no income were told, right, basically, this is where you have to go, and they would be even forced to go to the workhouse and kept in there as a virtual slave?
Well, yeah, as I said, they were forced to work in there, in a lot of cases, to death, and these were destitute families which would be separated, and in a lot of cases disabled people. I mean, and we're talking here physical disabilities, because of course anyone with a mental disability was sent to the bedlams, the lunatic asylums. So it's
okay, well, maybe we can talk about some more chapters next week, we'll see. You know, it sounds like an interesting little book you've got. Anyway, in the meantime, we go back now to talk hear from US filmmaker Alan Frankovich. He made the definitive film for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing, which was never repeated, but which you can view online. It's called The Maltese Double Cross, and it suggests there was a secret motive for the United States to blow up the Pan Am flight, which has been covered up pretty much ever since. Apparently nothing whatever to do with the Libyan Amal Megrahi, who was accused of it. Frankovich also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. It documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof, and even the IRA. Frankovich died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. He described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo.
But you're in the kind of situation where you have the same thing happening now in Honduras, and you have the same, and you have photographs being taken of people training in Miami and in California, and it's just like Miami in the early 60s. And if you actually sit down and watch this footage and look at the statements, I mean, you can see them circulating the same press releases almost, except changing the country from Cuba to Nicaragua.
You mentioned Cuba. I can't recall how much you went into this in your film. Was this a major topic? And wasn't there also a book recently that came out by Warren Hinkle, who's a friend of yours, that documents the U.S. operations against Cuba? What's the name of that book?
The name of it is The Fish is Red, which was the code word which they used to inform their underground in Cuba that the Bay of Pigs invasion was going to occur that day or week. Well, the film goes into the Cuban operation in some detail, because it's the first example of a major paramilitary operation which involved assassinations. It involved destroying the economy, and involved and this is told to you by Richard Helms. It involved blowing up bridges. It involved, as a matter of fact, Richard Helms in the film says, well, why should I have told the Congress about our attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro when we were essentially killing thousands of Cuban citizens in this program that went on in years?
Dengue fever, you know?
Well, really with bullets, not even getting into the exotic things. They were blowing up bridges, they were burning down sugar, they were bombing, there were terrorist attacks, so they were sponsoring. And what's interesting is through all of this, you know, if you talk to Americans, they think, like, Cuba is such a threat. There has not been, and the CIA has never accused the Cubans of killing a single American citizen in the United States. They have never accused the Cubans of blowing up a single American bridge, a single American industrial plant, and yet they feel perfectly justified to have done this over a period of time.
Ships, oil refineries, they've
everything
blown
they
up
could.
There, sugar cane, etc.
Mm-hmm. Chemical warfare,
right.
Bacteriological warfare.
In fact, now that I think of it, Bill Moyers made a CBS report called The CIA's Secret Army, that really documented the U.S. involvement in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Were there things that he left out there that you thought that...
Well, what he left out was, everyone was surprised to see these people give interviews so freely, but they had the habit of doing it. I mean, the CIA station mm-hmm. in Miami for years had been arranging for them to be interviewed because they wanted to create the impression that this was a huge movement, that there were all of these Cubans who were just raring to go in and liberate their homeland from tyranny, etc. And so a lot of what the CIA does is it's public relations of that sort. It's really creating the appearance of this huge movement. And everyone was surprised because, you see, I have a lot of the stories which go back to 60, 61, 62, that whole period. Every time the Cuban counter-revolutionary groups or the CIA groups like Alpha 66 had a convention. They filmed it, and there were interviews. And before the Bay of Pigs, I have footage of Cuban nationals going around, giving press conferences, and asking for recruits. Now, in the United States, according to the federal code, that is a criminal offense. You cannot mount, it's something they can put you in jail for 5 years.
You can't recruit foreign armies.
Exactly.
In the country. Well, how, Alan, would you characterize the CIA under Reagan? Are there new sorts of operations? Is it unleashed on a wider scale? Or is it more or less doing what it had been doing for decades?
Well, it's doing what it's been doing for decades, but in a different context, in the sense that internationally more people are aware of their methods. And I think Americans generally understand, some Americans understand. But the CIA now has the right to do things inside this country that it never legally could do before. In other words, and I'll predict that using the justification of fighting terrorism, and in some instances they are going to be encouraging and publicizing terrorist incidents in order to get everyone nervous, you're going to see them start doing things inside this country to control people they've been preparing to do for a period of time.
Well, that's Alan Frankovich there, the US filmmaker. He was interviewed in October 1982, you heard there, by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film all about the CIA, way back, yes, in 1982. More from him next week. Now I'm joined by Jeff Sparks for the What's On.
Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 11th of January, the jazz trio Small Days are performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Entry is £2 on the door, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on the 11th of January, Tom F. and James Graham will be performing at the Birdcage, which is at 28 Clare Street in Bristol. Entry is £2 on the door, and the gig starts at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Jonathan and Charlotte. They were Britain's Got Talent runners-up in 2012, and since then this duo have been signed and released their debut album together. Here is their version of the Queen classic, Who Wants to Live Forever, and is titled She May Vivra Per Sempre.
Now, Jeff, before we play this, I've just got to say to you, this is a bit of a departure for you, this kind of opera, isn't it? Are we going to be having a bit of Rossini in future as Song of the Week?
I think opera, yeah, we'll be going in that direction a bit more. Jonathan and Charlotte with their version of Who Wants to Live Forever, which was titled Je Me Vivra Per Sempre. For more information on them and to see when they are touring, you can go to www.jonathancharlotte.com. Into Saturday 12th of January, the Brew Shanks will be performing at the Birdcage in 28 Clare Street, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 7 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 13th of January, the Tender Trap will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and the gig starts at 4 p.m. That was all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Right, well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, believe it or not. Produced by volunteers and broadcast, thankfully, on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday, or even earlier in the week these days, when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Morris Kirk and Sabine McNeil. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. And anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753, which is mainly for school children and their parents, and possibly even teachers too. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, and wishing you a very good week. Thank you for listening, and until the same time next week, goodbye.
I'll be your friend, I can follow you.